This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is the Deep Dive, and this is Brooke Spector, and we are with you every Friday morning at 9 o'clock, just like we are every Friday morning. Here we are again. Today, we're going to take a slight detour from our usual collection of topics on international relations or foreign affairs or affairs of state. Or maybe it isn't. We'll find out. Today, we're going to speak to Heather Blackensee, and she's the head of Sacred Heart College in Observatory in Johannesburg, not Cape Town.
That's correct.
All right. And Sacred Heart College is a, does it start in elementary school and go through high school?
The wonderful thing, good morning, first
yeah.
of all.
Oh, yeah. Same way, right on the right track already. Here we go. And welcome.
And obviously, good morning to everybody who's listening. The wonderful thing is that we start at 4 months.
Ooh.
And I'll talk a little bit about why so early. And then obviously up to grade 12. So that's why we use the word college. Ah. Because it literally spans the entire educational experience of a child.
If the child is lucky, you have them for about 18 years before you let them go.
Close to that.
Yeah.
Close to that.
And by that point, they're thoroughly conditioned to what you want them to be.
Well, I wouldn't use the word conditioned because I hope they're critical thinkers, but definitely, definitely they are well immersed in the values of what Sacred Heart College okay. and the Marist community is about.
So the ghost of B.F. Skinner is not lying in wait.
Thank goodness not.
I did that deliberately. Heather has an interesting background. I mean, she taught obviously in South Africa, but she's also taught in Eswatini in a place called Big Bend, which I have visited on occasion. She taught at WITS. Her fields include physical science, natural sciences, and life sciences, and something which we obviously have to learn about called the Heart Zone, digital literacy and digital citizenship. And she's been a content advisor for 4 natural sciences textbooks. And one of the things she says she is particularly interested in is the growth and development of the teenage brain. And I realize that over the last number of years, it's become clear that the brain of a teenager is not yet fully and finely developed. And that apparently only locks in at about the age of 22 or 23.
Well, what's really fascinating is that even that information is shifting around.
To about 30?
Yeah, well, possibly there are aspects that kind of lock in at 23 if you're a male. But the wonderful thing about the brain is that it's so plastic. And even as you get older, sure, you may lose aspects, but your brain compensates. So neuroscience is just this burgeoning field, which is so exciting.
Especially now that they are nibbling right at the edges of the biochemical nature of memory and learning and consciousness and thought processes. Not quite over that threshold, but just peeking over the edge of the wall.
Yes, absolutely. There's this thought that the brain can't study itself. And I don't know if that's part of the part of the barrier, but we are learning so much. And I think really it was in 1995, 96, where that realization that the teenage brain isn't the static mini adult brain waiting to just get bigger and grow. Up until then, the thought was that the pre-primary and the primary school child, there was massive learning taking place. And then they said from about 95, there's been this wonderful explosion of knowledge around the brain. And as you say, that neurochemistry, because who understands how memories are stored? It's the most remarkable thing. And there's physical components to it. There's chemical components. So very exciting.
I remember when I was in high school, there was a big flurry of excitement just as scientists were really beginning to come to grips with messenger RNA, that it was possibly the pathway to memory.
Yes, exciting stuff.
And I did a science fair project with flatworms where you taught them to follow a maze. It seems bizarre, but nevertheless.
Yes.
And then you took the little creatures and you ground them up and fed them to others to see whether or not memory was transmissible chemically. And although other people said, and their results said it was, mine were obdurate. They never didn't help them. They just did what they wanted, even the cannibals. I mean, you know, so there we were. So I was right on the cusp of it and was unable to prove any of it.
Well, that's the nature of science. And yeah. Isn't that what's so exciting about it?
Right. A negative result is still a result.
Exactly.
And Heather says, and in some material that I was given ahead of time, our scholarship is more than just shaping a young person's future. It's an investment in our collective future as South Africa towards transformation. 15% of our students are beneficiaries of our scholarship program. That says to me that you also, in the process of dealing with all the normal things about teaching and managing and molding minds as best one can, you spend a lot of time shaking the tin cup.
Yeah. So that's really, really important because although we're in partnership with a number of organizations, quite often they're contributing between 25 and 50% of the scholarship. Mm. And that's just the tuition fees. And for us, our philosophy, and it has been for some time, is that when you offer a child a scholarship, particularly when you're looking at a student who comes from a previously disadvantaged background, you've got to create what I call a wraparound scholarship. So what I mean by that is you're not just paying for the tuition. You're paying for that student to walk into Sacred Heart College and actually feel like they are absolutely part of the community. They don't have to worry about where's my textbook coming from? Do I have Wi-Fi for the device that's been provided for me? Do I have uniform? Do I have textbooks, all of those very practical things, but then there's also very, very importantly the psychosocial and emotional aspects of coming into an environment that in actual fact is not part of your norm. And one of the challenges quite often is when a student is coming into a space like Sacred Heart College, where there is opportunity, students have the most remarkable sort of expanse of experiences and socioeconomic class. And then you go home to an environment where you're doing chores, where you have responsibilities at home. You may not even have a bedroom and
Everybody
should
do chores though.
I agree with you. And that's really important, but not when you have to get up at 4:30 in the morning, wash the family's clothes, make sure that in order to eat dinner that night, you have prepared it. And so for me, chores are a critical part of any child's upbringing, but not to the point where it is the sole function. And the assumption is that your education is taking place in the few hours that you're at school.
It builds character, even if it makes you fall asleep in that class.
Chores build character if they're done reasonably. And as I say, getting up at 4:30 in the morning to wash your clothes, so that you can actually wear them to school the following day, that I think is quite tough. But yes, helping wash the dishes, setting the table, help with the cooking, make your bed, polish your shoes, get your uniform out, all of those things. 100%.
Yeah, no, I'm joking, but
I appreciate that.
I mean, but you're also speaking to somebody who, you know, who worked part-time jobs all the way through and worked three jobs in university. So
sure.
I think I had sleep deprivation for about 5 years afterwards.
And that you're never going to catch up.
That's the theory, yeah. But Sacred Heart's special in a lot of ways. Obviously, it's a private school. It's heavily subsidized by others beyond the individual tuition payers.
Not necessarily. I must be quite honest.
Okay, you generate most of your...
Almost entirely our income comes from our fee base.
Okay.
Which is why, as you said earlier, I have to rattle that tin cup. Because if we don't find the money to fund these scholarships, then the onus on the school is to try and find that money somewhere else. And then that might mean cutting spending on other important aspects of our curriculum or our facilities. So we believe very much in investing in human capital. And, we are, as I say, probably about 95% of our income comes purely from our fees.
We're going to talk about money a lot more, but first we're going to take station ID and an ad break. This is Brooke Spector with The Deep Dive, and we're speaking with Heather Blankensee. I got it right.
That's right.
Head of Sacred Heart College and Observatory in Johannesburg, and we'll be right back. back.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is the Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, and my guest this morning is Heather Blankensief of Sacred Heart College in Observatory, and we're talking about not just her private school, her school. We're talking, I hope, about the larger canvas of education in South Africa, what it does, what it doesn't do, its challenges, its difficulties, and its potentials. But I think it's important for us all to remember that the South African educational system is really a series of systems, and they're not all the same. There's a collection of very ultra-expensive private schools, private parentheses, religiously based or religiously sponsored private schools. And then there are all those other public schools supported by government, ultimately by taxpayers, in which I think it's fair to say about 85 to 90% of the student population, that's where they go. I once did some research on schools in this country, and it astounded and horrified me to discover that if you took all the public schools, all, what was it, 23,000 of them or so, and you checked, 90% of them did not have the following things. They may have had some of them, but they didn't have all of them. Running water, functioning sanitation, a library, science labs appropriate to grade level, computer facilities, and internet connectivity. Some of them had 2, 3, 4, but very few of them had all of those things, things which you would expect to be absolutely fundamental for today's and tomorrow's educational needs. That's a terrifying thought.
I think there's, in addition to it being terrifying, I think we've got to acknowledge that there's a combination of factors. There's a historic debt that unfortunately owes its history to apartheid. So you'll find many of the, what people might have called the former Model C schools would have all of those. And those are incredibly successful schools, formerly whites only. And then many of the schools, certainly in the rural areas, probably wouldn't tick any of those boxes, and not even qualified teachers.
That was not part of my, I was looking at physical stuff as opposed to human resources.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so, if you added human resources, I think the number would probably climb to about 95%.
Yes, correct. So I think we've got to acknowledge the historic deficit. But having said that, I do think that even although a large percentage of our budget is allocated to education within the public sector, I don't believe it's used effectively, and I don't believe that it's been used to deal constructively with redress. And that is why you're still sitting with pit latrines. You're still sitting with places that don't have running water, where the concept of computers is in some cases just not accessible, but in other cases provided. And I've visited schools. I did some work both in Umlazi and in KwaZulu-Natal and in Limpopo, just as part of workshops and that sort of thing. And what horrified me was there was significant investment from certain organizations in terms of access to science equipment, and they were often locked up in the principal's office for many reasons.
Because that way they don't get broken or lost or stolen.
A, that's exactly it. B, the teachers don't have the expertise, or didn't at the time have the expertise, to actually engage with it. So that to me was a travesty. And I'm very aware of the immense investment, both from the private sector and the public sector, in terms of teacher education. But my concern is that we're not seeing it being translated into actual action on the ground.
You're talking about governmental investment in schools. I did another bit of research, and on a per capita basis, this country, now we're not talking about actual money, we're talking about per capita shares. This country spends more per student than places like the Netherlands, Canada, and on this continent, Morocco. And yet those three countries in particular do much better on those international scales of skills development and whatever those things are called. Those universal every year, every other year measuring sticks.
Yeah, kind of benchmarks.
I'm reaching desperately for the name of that study, and it'll come to me the moment we finish this broadcast.
Well, it's, yeah, I mean, the assessments are the PISA assessments. And
thank you. That's the one I was trying to think about.
Yeah.
Should have simply said the tower. Yeah. Anyway, you get my point is it confounds me that you don't always get what you pay for.
Well, that to me is, once again, it's multifactorial. It talks to a legacy of disadvantage, but it also talks to a poor vision. What always astounds me is Singapore. They had nation, and they literally created a war room around education, and they came up with the most remarkable approach to education, where they focused on the curriculum, they focused on teacher training within the colleges or the universities, but they also had pathways where older individuals who had experience in business and in other areas of life could actually enter into the teaching profession as they got older. And so there was this remarkable vision. And I just feel that we don't have the visionaries, firstly, around education, but it feels a lot like we don't have the political will. And that to me frustrates me and distresses me.
That allows you to sidle up to and not address the nature of the almost the clericalness, the way education is managed in this country.
Correct.
And we're referring in sort of in gentle terms to unions.
I think the unions have played a significant role and must take responsibility, certainly in the past, for really ring fencing schools and not allowing the kind of accountability that was needed within the schools. And certainly the fact, I mean, if I was a business person, I would ask myself, what is the return on the investment around the amount of money that, as you say, per capita has actually been invested in each student? And I do think that we have a lot to answer for within our country around education.
It's interesting you mentioned Singapore, because it's a place I spent some time in. And it started out as a poor country, city, stroke, country.
Yeah.
Its one advantage was that it was small enough to be manageable, that if you made a decision and, you know, all 2.5 million people, you could pay attention to who was getting, who was not getting.
100%.
But it went from being a relatively poor place comparative to most countries. But the government of then and now decided, just as you say, to say education is going to be one of those things that we are going to build brick by brick by brick upward, just as they did with the high tech industries. Mm-hmm. And it required civil servants who were very well paid relative to most places, but who were rigorously managed, tossed in a scrap heap if they didn't do their jobs well. Mm-hmm. Not just show up for work, but if you didn't do it right,
yes,
you were gone. Mm-hmm. And that high esprit de corps meant that there was a great deal of participation in getting things right. And it also had, it was a country in which there were many languages and multiple ethnicities, not all of whom liked particularly or got along well with each other.
Absolutely.
And for whom there were significant disparities in quality of knowledge and background and experience.
Absolutely. And there, you know, there are a number of countries that have gone through a very similar, very conscious approach. So South Korea would be another example.
But they at least were homogeneous in population.
Yes, yes. And I think you could argue the same about Finland. But once again, there was a very, very conscious effort. Their performance against America was, you know, America and Finland were kind of performing at the low level against other countries. And then once again, there was a very conscious decision to change the system. But what they did was they, their accountability for teachers was in the form of making sure that they had master's degrees, that they were well paid, that they were treated as professionals. And the most amazing thing for me about the schools in Finland, besides the curriculum, is that every single school is a neighborhood school. Now, that works in Finland because then regardless of where you are, the education has to be similar. I think in South Africa, it's quite hard to translate a similar system. There's a lot of talk about that. A lot of people are saying, you know, look, Finland turned it around. Why don't we adopt the Finnish model? I have reservations about that for all sorts of reasons, but it's got to be a focus. There's got to be an intention. And I know this is a very controversial thing to say, but it feels to me in part that it suits our politicians to have an undereducated population. Because then you're not asking critical questions, you're not challenging. Although I must say I'm really pleased to see civic organizations starting to do that. But it concerns me that it's taken so long, but let's not get away from education.
We're going to take another short break. This is Brooke Spector with The Deep Dive, and today's guest is Heather Blankenship, head of Sacred Heart College and Observatory in Johannesburg, and we'll be right back.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, your host, as we are every week, 9 o'clock, and we're speaking with Heather Blankenship, head of Sacred Heart College and Observatory, and we're talking about education. We're talking about the needs for improvement in it, the way you improve it, and inspirations from other countries. And so far we've been to Singapore and South Korea and Finland. And I just read a survey this morning, in fact, about Estonia, which is doing similar things the way Finland would, you know, right across the Gulf from each other. They're one of the things that they have started to do is something I've never heard the term before, looping.
Maybe explain it to me and I'll see if I've heard of it before.
Well, you have. Suddenly there's a term for it now. What it means in essence is that at least for 3 or 4 grades, children get the same teacher.
Yes, absolutely. And
so that the teacher not only knows their material, but they know the students and their aptitudes and their differences and the way in which they learn or don't learn, as well as the pressures on them, builds not just trust, but an ability to pull out the best from each of their students. Now that presupposes you don't have 100 kids in a class, but sure. It's something that was the norm in the U.S. in small towns and farming communities 100 years ago. And that's vanished now in part. But we do expect that specialized subject teachers see their children over multiple years.
Absolutely.
We just don't expect that math and science teachers do.
Well, interestingly enough, we at Sacred Heart College, we have in fact actually looked at that.
You're doing looping and you don't know it.
Yeah. No, well, we kind of, yeah, I think we wouldn't have given it a term.
But it is,
we might have argued that it was continuity, but for us, it's about trying to ensure that certainly, from a partial care point of view, in the high school, the students have the same tutor. That's kind of what you might call a registered teacher, and the same grade coordinator. And they follow the student from grade 7 all the way up to grade 12. And in part, that's as a result of a high school needing more specialized teachers. But we do try and have the maths teacher take the classes up in a particular phase. That's critically important for that very reason. Same thing in grade 10, 11, 12. We do our very best to ensure that there's continuity for the maths teacher, the history teacher, the English teacher. There might be a little bit of movement across classes for all sorts of reasons, but that's definitely the practice. And you mentioned Estonia. What's fascinating, and I'm looking at this with interest, is the adoption of the Finnish model in India.
That's about as different a society as you can
arrange. Because I've always been a little skeptical of that model. and being transplanted into a place like South Africa, I believe each context needs its own solutions, but I look with interest to see how they achieve it. But for me, really, I know we're going backwards, but at the heart of good education is experiential learning. And I think that's what Finland has got right. And I think the focus that is needed in that case is to actually give the students an opportunity to see the relevance of their learning. Because I do think that many, many systems, and I count the UK and the US in this, and that it is too focused on an endpoint, whether it's O levels, GCSEs, A levels, or a school leaving certificate, for me, or a matric. For me, that standardized test at the very end is just too high stakes and pressurized and doesn't measure learning.
In America, they now call it teach to the test.
Correct.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And I mean, but by the same token, place like China, South Korea, Japan, Taiwan, the pressure to pass through a narrow doorway with the exam with doing well on the exam to get into university or a government job, or that pressure is extraordinary.
Well, it's similarly here in South Africa. You know, that matric certificate is kind of like getting your foot on the first rung of a ladder. And a significant, I mean, close to 50% of our grade ones don't even get a chance to write that matric exam because of the massive dropout, and those that write, don't succeed. So for me, I'm not an expert in public education, so all of this is just my opinion, but,
informed opinion, yes, based on 30 sure. plus Amazon shares of the dog, this question.
No, absolutely. But I'm a lot more comfortable looking at critiquing, education within the independent sector and the fact that comes with significant privilege, except of course where you do offer those students the opportunity, to be part of a school from the point of view that they may not have had access previously.
I want to ask you another question, and this is the kind of question that we could discuss this for hours. Mm-hmm. How do you take the experience and the success rate and the circumstances of your school and transfer them to public education? We've had lots of experience with our own children in private and public schools around the world, and trying to see the commonalities is interesting and difficult. But here the challenge is, how do you take what you manage to do and send that to the other 20 some thousand schools that don't have that texture?
Well, once again, maybe it's because I'm a teacher and that's where my bias lies, but I really believe that if you have a well-trained, excellent teacher who is able to unpack critical concepts, get children to think creatively, make their learning relevant, then in actual fact, doesn't matter what your curriculum looks like, to be perfectly honest, because the teacher decodes and identifies what relevant learning looks like. So for me, it's about investing in the teachers, and that's what we do a lot at Sacred Heart. Our teachers are constantly going on workshops. We do a lot of professional development within the school itself. And what I would do, and what we actually do is we partner with schools and mentors. So we might have principals from some of the low-fee Catholic schools come and visit us and look at best practice. We share our best practice with those schools. And so that's critically important. But you've got to be very careful when you set up those partnerships, because you've got to make sure that you're not giving people an excuse when they walk into a well-resourced school to believe that it's the resources that make a good education. Okay. It's the people and the investment in those people.
You're really saying Socrates and a student on the log.
100%.
Except there's no longer Socrates and somebody else. We're going to take another quick break. This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector, and our guest today is Heather Blankensy, head of Sacred Heart College and Observatory. And we will be right back.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and my guest today is Heather Blankensee, the head of Sacred Heart College in Observatory. And we were talking about the criticality or the centrality of good teachers. But I want to pose a slightly different question to you. You go back to work today, you're in your office, and there's a phone call, and it's the personal secretary of Angie Mochekwa, and she says, Heather, I've heard lots of good things about you, and I've decided that what we need is an education czar in my department, and you will have my full backing to do whatever you want to fix our education system. We're not doing it right somehow, and I'll back you in Parliament, and I'll back you with the other parts of the government, but I can't give you any more money. What do you do?
Sure. On the spot, that's a tough question.
Oh, but I warned you about
that. Just saying, I mean, in terms of it, for me, first of all, I think the word czar, implies, you know, kind of this, very authoritarian, you know, kind of authoritarian, but I understand what you're saying. Somebody who's got unlimited power.
Who has the ability to cut through the bureaucratic.
Yeah, that's what I'm hearing you say. So.
As opposed to an authoritarian, do it my way or the highway.
So for me, the very first thing is that, I would focus on creating that wall. And I know we've had, you know, electricity war rooms and all sorts
war
of
things. War rooms and war rooms.
Yeah, you know, or commissions of inquiry and that sort of thing. So
next thing I was a study commission and a task team.
Correct. Yeah. So for me, I think because it is so multifaceted, you've got to surround yourselves with experts within each of those fields. And we've got to cut this private public, divide. And we've got to, I would identify the people within the different sectors where excellence exists, whether that is in a rural school, inner city school, a school in townships, regardless. And then I would look in a very, very focused way to start to build at ECD, which I know there's a lot of investment in there.
ECD, no academics allowed here.
Okay, early child development space. And I know there's a lot of work there, but the fact of the matter is, you have got to create nutritional programs. They exist, but are they being effectively implemented? You've got to also look at the teachers coming in, you know, the people that you're recruiting. It's got to be a very conscious process of recruiting. Distressed me many years ago, I don't know, maybe 10 or more years ago, when in actual fact they made access to a Bachelor of Education degree so much more accessible. You really just could get into it regardless of what your, you know, there was a minimum requirement for points. So we've got this cohort of teachers who went into education who don't believe, you know, it was just a means to an end. So for me, what I would say to Minister Mochekwa is give me the opportunity to cut through all of the red tape. Let's look at where that spending is getting frittered away. Because if you've got all of that money going into the education sector, let's channel it into spaces where we are looking at teacher education, teacher remuneration, redirect some of that funding, look at, as you say, the physical infrastructure. And I know the government is doing this, but I don't think they're doing it fast enough. And I don't think they're doing it consciously enough. I think there is huge amounts of corruption that is eating away at chunks of that kitty. So for me, it's ECD, primary school, actually reevaluating teacher education, whether it's preset, you know, learning. I would have every teacher do an internship in a high functioning school, so that they can see what good teaching is like. Because there's a lot of research that says learning at the knee of Betty. And what that means, it was coined by the Dean of Education at BITS. And what it's saying is you teach the way you were taught. So you've got to break that pattern. And you've got to give those teachers, and teaching practice of 6 weeks don't achieve it, because it's still too short a period of time. So you've got to match your student teachers with schools that are high functioning schools as interns, and they get to see what good teaching looks like.
I lost track of the number of oxen that have been gored by what you have just said out.
Yes, I get it.
You have made enemies in every possible sphere at this point with this.
Well, you asked me a question and I am the czar.
Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, the reason why I ask it, of course, is because there's a general acceptance that things are not as they should be. Too many teachers do not have the skills to match the material they are supposed to be imparting, let alone the capabilities to do it. And those are two slightly different things, obviously. And as a result, South Africa falls down in that nether region on those PISA scales. And that's no way to turn the country into a knowledge-intensive industrial powerhouse of the current century.
And yeah, unfortunately, I did gore a whole lot of oxen, but the fact of the matter is, there's a study that came out, I think it was referenced on Friday, and it says that, and I can't remember the exact statistic, but it was close to 50% of our teachers are unable to read for meaning and have literacy levels of a grade six. And then we wonder why our grade fours, the actual students that are being taught by these teachers, also have such low levels of literacy and comprehension. So for me, it's too urgent for us to not take, for us to pussyfoot around and worry about people's sensitivities. There is a need at every level for a kind of a sort of a surgeon's incision to really come in and be precise about what we do. To say whether it's at the universities that are doing the teacher training, whether it's within the schools. And when I talk about in the schools, I'm not talking about having inspectors come in and cracking
the next.
Because the fact of the matter is, you don't create professional teachers by having a big stick looming over their head. You achieve it through them becoming experts, becoming trusted in their space, and shifting the mindset. And I think it's a massive paradigm shift that speaks to the fact that teachers care deeply for their students, but they get frustrated, they get distressed because they are hamstrung either by a department that is so bureaucratic, because it's trying to develop this accountability, or by the fact that they haven't been given the skills to cope in a classroom. And I mean, we haven't even ventured. We're talking, you know, at the most basic level, we haven't even ventured into the fourth industrial revolution. And I'm pretty sure the fifth is literally on our, I was going to say it's literally here.
That's
we haven't figured it out yet.
That's the Internet of Things where the refrigerator tells you stop and pick up a quart of milk. Yeah.
And not only that, nanotechnology. So for me, we haven't even got the fundamentals right. And we're trying to just sandwich on top some of the more sophisticated stuff. And so, yeah, I don't envy people who are leading education. But I do think that we've been allowed, to get away with really poor quality education across the board.
This is The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, and we're talking with Heather Blankensee, who is the head of Sacred Heart College and Observatory. We'll take a break, and then we'll be right back.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is The Deep Dive. Brooke Spector is your host, and we're speaking with Heather Blankensee of Sacred Heart College and Observatory, and we are deconstructing and rebuilding the entire educational system in the next 8.5 minutes, we will fix it all and give it to you this afternoon. Angie Mocheco has given her the free reign to do whatever she wants, kill all the sacred cows there are, and take care of things. But there's one thing you've left out, in which my wife, who is a teacher of years of experience, would probably smack me on the head for not remembering to talk about, and that's teachers' colleges. There used to be many of them. Instead, you have departments of or schools of education where, to some considerable degree, educational research becomes more important than the quality training of the people who will do teaching. And in your mind, is it appropriate to rebuild in some new way? I don't mean the old set of teacher training colleges necessarily, but to rebuild a process where the training or capacitating or whatever fancy word we want of teachers is more important than somebody doing survey research about the knowledge of phonemes.
I mean, I think the fact that a number of colleges of education were subsumed into universities, and those that were standalone was a travesty. And I'm not entirely sure if the fact that they've been subsumed into universities has shifted the focus significantly. I do think there is always an imperative to do the research. And I think that's critical to any progress in education. I would argue that what is taught at those colleges needs to be relevant, needs to be up to date. And that's why I'm proposing that mentorship and internship, where the students who are currently going through the 3 or 4 years of their degree are actually attached to a school. And so that to me is as important. And as you were referring to teachers, you know, to teachers' colleges, what I'd also like to propose is that you have to look at a partnership with the families, the parents, because I do think that what has happened is, because of pressures and all sorts of socioeconomic contexts, the home has become separated from the schools. And so there's a disconnect between what's happening in the school environment and at home. The reason a lot of systems work sometimes is because of that partnership between the parent, the child, and the home. So the dysfunction within that relationship also undermines what's happening in education.
One tiny corner of my thinking is that there is one very tiny corner, the old regime that had it righter than wrong, in that teachers were highly valued and one word from the teacher to a parent got results.
Look, I think that I don't know if that really happens.
Or am I just imagining that?
I think it was a particular era in the history of most societies, actually. I think that it comes with respect, it comes with partnership, rather than with this authoritarian relationship. Mm-hmm. But if we're going to talk about that, then I think it's worth talking about it takes a village to raise a child. And I think the same applies to the education of a child. So that investment of a community and a society in the schools that are situated in that community is an integral part of educational success.
We have been talking with Heather Blankensy, who is the head of Sacred Heart College and Observatory, and school that many people I know think very highly of in the way in which it imparts not just education, but values, and not just personal values, but almost communitarian values, if you like that word. I put her on the spot and I asked, and I said, I've just appointed you czar of education. How do you fix things? Angie, if you're listening, get a hold of Heather this afternoon and see what we can arrange. She has a whole plan of action worked out. We want you to take her up on this. It's been a pleasure to speak with you this morning. I've enjoyed this a lot.
Thank you. I've thoroughly enjoyed being here. And as you say, education is just such a vast space and it's so complex, but at the end of the day, it's about the students and it's about our future. And if we don't get it right, that's our own fault.
And this is Brooks Factor with The Deep Dive. Our conversation has been with Heather Blankensy of Sacred Heart College. And we'll be back again next week with a different look at something interesting, important, informative, and hopefully something you haven't thought of yet.